I'm so glad you guys had three choices today, and you chose us. So on behalf of the panelists here, we were kind of like, who's going to choose us, you know? So thank you. Thank you for choosing us. let me see. Today, we are going to have a stimulating conversation. I know this is going to be stimulating. I have no doubt. We were just rehearsing quite a bit, and there was a lot of blood in this rehearsal. So I promise you stimulation and a really invigorating conversation around the F word. And you guys know what I'm talking about, right? Funding, right. So here's some context into the conversation around funding today. As you guys have heard already, the EA movement has already moved millions of dollars into causes and into areas where we think that we're going to do a lot of good. And the hope is that we're going to move billions more in the future. So this conversation and these panelists are going to help us think about how do we invest our money best, you know, which funding models make sense from their experiences, and how do we move resources in impactful ways. So those are kind of the kind of questions we want to sort of get some insight into from these wonderful people. And with that, I just want to introduce each of our panelists to you today. And I'm going to start with the person on my left, which is Brian Johnson. You can think of Brian as someone who has a lot of experience in impact investing and also entrepreneurship. Brian's the founder of OS Fund, which he launched last year with $100 million of his personal capital to support inventors and scientists who aim to benefit humanity by rewriting the operating systems of life. One of the companies that OS Fund invests in is called Human Longevity, which endeavors to cure age-related diseases and radically extend human healthy life to 100 years and beyond. In 2007, Brian founded Braintree. You might have heard of that company, an online and mobile payments provider that was bought by eBay and PayPal in 2013. He's also an outdoor adventure enthusiast, a pilot, and an author of a children's book. So thank you for being here, Brian. Next, we have Miguel Vega Pisana, who is an expert in global health and sustainability. Miguel is the chief communications officer at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where he's focused on increasing awareness and engagement for global poverty, health, and U.S. education issues. Prior to joining the foundation, Miguel served as vice president at Unilever, where he was responsible for driving global advocacy on key sustainability priorities. And he also led Unilever's engagement across the United Nations post-2015 Sustainable Development Goals. Thanks, Miguel, for being here. All right, two down, two to go. The next panelist I'm pleased to introduce you to is Jason Matheny, whose specialty is in government and global catastrophic risk. Jason is an office director at IARPA, where he directs federal funding to advance research. His group funds large research firms and teams, for example, around quantum computers, machine learning, high-performance computing, and biology. Growing up, Jason was influenced by moral arguments for charity and became a vegan as a teenager. He went to business school and, quote unquote, lived cheaply and donated most of my income. He previously worked at Oxford, the World Bank, the Applied Physics Labs, and the Applied Physics Laboratory and Princeton University. Thanks, Jason. And last but not least, we have Carrie Vaughn, I would say is probably the strongest voice of EA on the panel. So he's just sort of like the EA god hanging out in the corner. Carrie is, you probably have seen him up on stage already. He's a managing director of the EA Ventures, responsible for putting this awesome event together, has completed a PhD in philosophy, and a couple other things I think people have already said about you, like the poker player stuff. Did you want to add anything else?
Nope.
Okay. So he's a poker player, and he used to work at a foundation. Great, well, thank you all for being here. You ready? Quite a panel. So I think, you know, we have a whole hour. It's a lot of time. And I'm going to start and just kind of ease into things with some sort of maybe some basic questions to learn more about your organizations. And I'm going to mix it up a little bit, okay? So I have a 8-year-old nephew. And he lives in Detroit, Michigan. His name is Rayon. And I would love for you to explain what you do and what your organization is doing to an 8-year-old Rayon, just to make it really simple. So I'm going to start with Brian.
Okay. So I would say, that's a really good question. I'd say humanity is defined by the tools they have. So when we had hammers, we can build houses. When we have wet labs, we can produce chemistry experiments. So the question is, what tools of creation do we have today? And what tools could you use? And what kind of world would you build? And then I would talk about specifically why our time and place in the arc of humanity is unique, in that we can literally program any kind of world we can imagine. If you take computer software or biology, genomics, AI, we can program anything via a virtual reality. And so I would try to impress upon him that he lives in this remarkable age of creation, and that he can choose which tools he becomes proficient at, and then he can use those to create any kind of world that he can imagine, and try to orient him to pursuing endeavors that he finds meaningful and purposeful.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And that's what you've done.
Yeah, so I invest in what I call tools of creation, the mm-hmm. things that will define humanity in our future.
Cool. Thanks. Miguel.
Okay. So... the foundation has this, it starts with this belief statement. We say that we believe that all lives have equal value. And at the foundation, we talk a lot about being what we call impatient optimists. And what that means is that we think that the world can solve some of these huge challenges, but we're not doing it quickly enough. And the second piece is that we are optimistic that you can, these solutions are within our grasp. And really what we're trying to do is alleviate poverty. Mm-hmm. We do that by focusing primarily on helping people lead healthier lives and then creating the opportunity for more people, particularly in terms of their economic empowerment, to be able to reach those economic opportunities and fulfill them. And that's essentially what we're trying to do at the foundation.
Thank you. That was simple.
It's for an 8-year-old.
Thank you. Jason.
So I think I would ask your nephew if he's seen a James Bond movie. Okay. And there's the guy in the lab coat in the back, whose name is Q, is developing the gadgets.
Okay.
So where I work at IARPA, we fund Q. So we don't have Q in our building. Instead, we find the best and brightest scientists and engineers from around the world and ask them to work on the hardest problems that we have in areas of global security. Things like, can we detect where there are nuclear weapons? Can we detect where there are biological weapons? Can we detect the emergence of new diseases before they break out? Can we detect new forms of malware before they affect critical infrastructure? And the way we work to find these cues around the world is to put out calls for competitively awarded research. We fund over 300 different organizations, colleges, universities, small businesses, large businesses, nonprofits. And we run tournaments for this research so that we have multiple teams working on the same problem in parallel, and we keep score. So we sort of act as the referees. We set what the goal line is, and then we measure progress almost compulsively towards that goal. We give more funding to those who are succeeding, and we pull funding from those who aren't succeeding, or we reallocate funding to problems where we can make more progress. And we use prize-driven competitions for this. One of the things that some of you all may have known about or even been involved with was we staged the world's largest forecasting tournament. Focused on geopolitical events, in which over 10,000 people from around the world forecasted things like political elections or multilateral treaties or interstate conflict. And our goal was to figure out what distinguishes the people who are most accurate from those who are less accurate. What is it about them that makes them special? I think something that's of interest to this group is that it wasn't the deep domain experts who were most accurate. It was the people who were good Bayesians. Who were constantly updating their judgments, looking for disconfirming evidence, who had great critical thinking skills, high fluid intelligence. So I think our model of running these sorts of large tournaments with, in that case, tens of thousands of queues is what distinguishes us from other funders.
I can see it already, all those queues getting together. Yeah, it's amazing.
That's right. Lots of lab coats.
Lots of lab coats. Thank you. Carrie.
Yeah. So I would say, if I was describing it to an 8-year-old, there's a bunch of people walking around with money, and they want to give that money to people who are going to make the world, who are going to improve the world. And there's a bunch of people who have projects that need money so that they can, you know, use their projects to improve the world. And for some reason, those people don't always meet. So what I do is I take the people who have the money, I take the people who have the projects, I smush them together, good things happen. We also like evaluate the projects to make sure that they look like it's a good use of the funder's time. But that's the basic essence. Take people who have money, take people who have projects, bring them together.
Smush them together. Cool. What do you guys think? Aren't these answers pretty good? I like that. I think we should always talk as if we're talking to 8-year-olds. It's just so much easier, isn't it? Thank you for all those, I think, you know, overviews of what you guys are doing. I'm going to throw in another question out there because we haven't necessarily dug into the types of organizations that you're funding. But, you know, how do you think about, this is one of the hot topics, you know, as of late, is, you know, how do you think about the for-profit funding models versus nonprofit funding models? Brian, I know you have some very strong opinions on funding with nonprofits versus for-profits, so I'd love to hear you kick that off.
Yeah, so I guess some personal context.
And what's more effective, I guess, is a question, too.
Yeah, we talked a lot about this before. My personal context is I spent 2 years living in Ecuador with people shackled with extreme poverty when I was 21, and I came home to the United States with this desire to improve people's lives. I wanted to devote my life to that objective. And so I asked the question, like, how would I possibly do that? How would I utilize my time and energy living to do that? And I contemplated what I could contribute. Like, could I become a writer, a teacher? Could I go into science? Could I become a mathematician? And there was I didn't really have a skill set that was obvious. I didn't really think I was very good at anything. So I thought, you know what? I'll just become an entrepreneur. I'll make a whole bunch of money. I'll retire by 30, and then by then I will have figured out, you know, what I care about. And so over that decade, I spent an enormous amount of time thinking about humanity and where humanity is going. And so I achieved my goal, and I now have an abundance of capital to use in the world. And I use capital as a tool to accomplish certain objectives, and I want that resource to continually grow. My philosophy has been if I give it away to a foundation, or if I give it away as a foundation, I no longer have that tool. It dwindles itself. If I use it in a for-profit model, it can potentially increase, and I can do more. And so I've tried to structure a mechanism and a fund that can accomplish the largest amount of, I don't want to say impact or good, we can talk about that later, with this model. And so the way I think about the fund is the best way to do good is to build good technology, instead of starting with a values-based assessment. And so I'm very bullish that for-profit models using the market mechanisms of the marketplace produce the optimal outcomes for human flourishing. And that's the model I've chose to with my personal capital.
Cool. Thank you. Miguel, maybe you can comment on that. Brian just mentioned, you know, he found that, you know, capital is a tool and using that to increase to do more. Particularly in the for-profit sector, was what was most effective. How do you think about that at the Gates Foundation, where I believe, you know, you have a very different approach?
Yes and no, because we partner and invest in the private sector. So I tend to take a view that it's not one or the other, it's both. Mm-hmm. I think that there is definitely a role for government. There's definitely a role for philanthropy and the private sector. And I think some of the things that I think we need to still see a critical role for governments or for, you know, not-for-profit sector to do are the things where the market mechanisms just don't work. And there's quite a number of areas where that's true. So I do believe, however, that the private sector is a critical delivery agent. If you invest in the right innovation, the right technology, mm-hmm. and if you can get that into the market quickly and accelerate that process, you can have way more impact. But within the foundation, what we're doing is we're trying to identify those places where the market just isn't delivering. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in vaccines, this is an area we have a big focus on ending the five biggest killer diseases for the poorest. So this is polio, it's malaria, it's pneumonia, it's TB, it's HIV. And these are areas where you have a huge amount of investment that's gone in, but the market doesn't work, and actually the poorest can't afford the drugs that are available. So part of our model is how do we then collaborate with the private sector or stimulate upstream innovation that isn't happening right now in order to create more affordable vaccines, and then we have to figure out the distribution system to get them into the hands of the poor. Mm-hmm. And that isn't a model that picks, you know, we pick and choose, essentially, and I don't think you, I don't make it as hard and fast as for profit is better than for not for profit. I think there's a role for both.
Mm, interesting. Any other views? So I think we've heard Brian's more on the for profit. You're seeing more like collaboration, partnership. Any other thoughts on that sort of topic?
I mean, I think probably 2/3 of the work that we fund is research that's done by for profit businesses, but they wouldn't do the research otherwise if we weren't paying them. Mm-hmm. So I think. There, as Miguel noted, there are market failures. There are problems that the commercial sector is not on its own going to work on. And in fact, you know, it would be against their fiduciary responsibilities for them to work on, either because it involves future generations or it involves something that can't be capitalized. But there is a natural role then for government to fund mm-hmm. that type of work. And I would say... probably 2/3 of the innovation that we're seeing in our programs is due to the commercial sector being paid to work on those problems. Mm-hmm. The other third, though, are nonprofits, including academia, where there's incredible concentrations of human capital that are focused on far-range problems of global scale. Mm-hmm. So that's why we continue to fund competitive work at universities and colleges.
I'd also add that I think that it's uncommon you hear someone sing the praises of government to say, wow, it's such an amazing organization, they just do such wonderful stuff. But the reality is far different, that the government and academia have been so important to society, right, of funding these key pipelines of technological development, space and the internet and even biology. And that then when the decades of work have been done, it goes to the commercial sector and then people they commercialize it, and they get all the kudos. Like, wow, what a crazy invention. But really, it was done by the government. So I agree there's a role for government and academia to play in the development of technology that has the potential to improve our lives. I use the remark that basically the capital I have, that the role I play in the ecosystem is when it reaches that point of commercialization, that I just don't have enough money to fund the pre-commercialization product development.
Yeah. And I think that's true for a lot of different players, including in the private sector. So increasingly, you're very reliant on either government or academia to do a lot of that. And that's the real challenge. And the challenge that they face is how to commercialize it. So that's where the other bridge has to be. And what we're finding, though, is, for example, I'll give you one live example. So we were looking at the issue of meningitis in West Africa. And what's available? There is a meningitis vaccine. The problem was it cost $7 or $8. When you asked the government what could you afford to pay for a vaccine, they said 79 cents. Mm-hmm. So there's a gap. It's not that it's not there. It's just too expensive. People couldn't afford to buy it. Governments couldn't afford to buy it. So one of the solutions we came up with is how do we go out there and actually challenge the sector to come up with a 79 cents vaccine, which happened 3 years later. Mm-hmm. It was an Indian company that actually helped to commercialize that vaccine. The challenge number two was then how we get the governments to be able to afford to buy those vaccines and start to then do the immunization programs on the ground. So we partnered with governments to help create the funds, Gavi Fund, which is essentially a fund that stimulates it raises funds from government and the private sector to help to do the on-the-ground immunization programs. Combine those two things together, and you actually get things to happen on the ground. But neither of them can be done without the other.
Perfect. Thank you. Those are like just some really good thoughts on that. And I think there's still so much more in that conversation. But I'm going to switch gears a little bit, and I'm going to throw a question at Carrie. So Carrie, we had a chat yesterday about how your effective altruism ventures is smushing together, like you said, the funders and then these great ideas, right? And I asked you, what are the sort of criteria that you're thinking about as you fund, and you mentioned how it was pretty broad. I think the words that came up were causes that were important, tractable, neglected. So just wanted to get your thoughts on, the sense of the breadth approach you're taking you know, and like why you're taking such a broad approach to funding. And then, you know, maybe we can hear some other ideas from panelists who are taking more depth approaches.
Sure. So we kind of take all comers. So anybody can like show up at our website. It's eaventures.org. And you can apply with your project. And somebody will look at it. High probability it'll actually be me. I don't know if that's the right approach or not. So one advantage of taking all comers is I think there's probably an order, like orders of magnitude difference between the most effective and the least, and like the median cause. And so we're more likely to find things that are like outrageously effective because they might be from an area that I've never heard of, but I look into it and it turns out that's a really good idea. On the sort of flip side, like we don't have any domain level expertise on a lot of the projects we look at. We look at kind of general criteria like team composition. We look at the kind of success mechanisms of the project. But we're not experts. So I think that probably increases the probability that we fund things that aren't going to work. Like maybe if we'd known some technical knowledge about the thing we're funding, we would have been like, oh, this is a terrible idea. So it's like, you know, maybe we fund less, like maybe we have like a lower success rate, but maybe we have like a higher total expected value. So that's been kind of our approach. It's like a very EA approach to be like very cause neutral. But I have no idea if it's the right approach. And it's possible that you should specialize and only invest in things that you have like lots of domain level knowledge about.
Love to get thoughts from some of you who might have, I'm guessing, have a lot more domain level expertise. You know, what do you think of Carrie's approach? You know, how would you pivot from something like that? Or just get your thoughts on that.
So I guess I would say that most of the wealth in the world is maintained by people who don't have scientific expertise. Yet some of the biggest challenges we have facing humanity require scientific expertise. And so much of the funding sits on the sidelines because it's easier to fund oil or real estate or something that's much more understandable. And so I don't have scientific expertise. And so the question became, how do we fund hard science endeavors in an intelligent way that would produce successful outcomes? And we've been trying to create, we hired a group of PhDs and scientists. We built this model of decision analysis of trying to correct our biases and blind spots. So when we bring a company in and say, will they be successful and what's the criteria? Because we found all these problems in humans analyzing data. And so I'm hoping that we can open source this model in time so the whole community can use it to bring more capital in to invest in hard science. But I think that's how we build our scientific tools, our tools of creation via scientific endeavors is the most important question. And in existential risks and everything else we do, solving the big problems that face humanity, and without sufficient capital to do so, I think we'll struggle to rise to the occasion.
So can I ask a question about that? So it seems like you think that the market mechanism's broken when it comes to like breakthrough innovations or something. Like capital doesn't flow correctly to new things that are totally different than things that have existed before. And I've heard like a lot of people, I think Peter Thiel says something like this. So I'd be interested in like why you think that's the case. Because it seems plausible that market mechanisms could work for breakthrough innovations. You know, we do like somewhat regularly produce breakthroughs. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on like why that's the case.
I think so. I don't say the market is not good at making breakthroughs. I think it is good at making breakthroughs. I think in emerging areas, take synthetic biology that came of age this past decade, and venture capitalists came in and really got their ass kicked, right, in terms of they really didn't make much money, and the same with green energy. Mm-hmm. And so I think the key question is if the government or academia or whoever's building the pipeline to get it to a certain state of commercial funding, the question is who's going to fund it and over what duration of time and how many times can they fail before they do it. And so we have these really important technologies. Like we have, Jason, you and I were talking before about in 2003, you guys were saying, wow, synthetic biology could be used in 2014 to create polio, right, from scratch.
Smallpox,
mm-hmm. Right, from scratch. And so the question is, how do we fund the ecosystem so it develops in time to address both the strengths and weaknesses? And to me, my assessment is there's not enough capital with the right funding models to make it go fast enough.
Yes, because I think that's the issue. It's the acceleration. It's the piece about how do you accelerate that transition. And I mean, in our case, we do that now as the foundation. Something we didn't do 5 years ago is we increasingly give guarantees as a way of mitigating the risk, because some of these guys will not take that risk, actually particularly with the private sector. I mean, we think that some of the work we've been doing with, you know, some fairly big pharmaceutical companies in this whole area of research in vaccines, for example, like for polio or malaria, which are particularly tough nut to crack, or HIV, where we're still, you know, possibly 10 years away from a vaccine. We are kind of working with them both to have a mechanism for price guarantee, so we can actually know when it is commercialized, the price will be affordable from the get-go. So when it gets into the market, it will come in at a price that people can afford. or number, or most critically, we're actually de-risking some of their investment decisions that they're making so that we become a partner with them on that. And we think we've taken about $1 billion out of the costs of vaccines just from doing some of that de-risking work with companies like Merck or Bayer and others. So there's a lot that you can do in that space.
Very interesting. Okay, my next question is going to be for Jason. Jason, imagine I'm a cause-neutral EA, as I should be. You know, the work you do is really interesting, and it's around a topic area that maybe not a lot of people know about. So I'm cause-neutral. Make the case for global catastrophic risk and the kind of work that you do. 30 seconds.
Sure. So my background actually was in global health, and I worked in actually evaluating a Gates Foundation project in India. While I was in India, I was working with people who had worked on the smallpox eradication campaign. This was in 2003. And that same year, a lab successfully synthesized a virus from scratch. And we could sort of see how this was going to play out in the future, creating organisms that not only we thought we had eradicated, such as smallpox, but organisms that don't arise naturally but have properties that make them worse than any natural infectious disease. And I thought about whether then I should shift from global health to global catastrophic risks. And I did for the reason that, in general, thanks to Gates and to other global health organizations, we're making enormous progress. I mean, if you look past the last 50 years, the slope of improvement in human welfare is extraordinary. And I think that slope will continue thanks to you know, smart, enterprising people like those in this room if we don't get derailed by catastrophe. So I sort of saw a place where I could have leverage was to work on these lower probability, high consequence events that could sort of derail the progress that we were generally making as a civilization. And I guess the argument that I would make for it is if we don't safely navigate, I think, the next few decades, the opportunity cost of that would be so high because there's such great potential for human flourishing, as Brian would say. So much great welfare gains that can be made in the future if we manage to safely navigate these next few decades.
Thank you. It's pretty compelling. Does anyone else have a elevator pitch that they'd like to share about a cause area that they're very passionate about? Or we can continue. It's fine. I have lots of questions.
We're all about public.
Okay. Actually, this next section is all about unexpected surprises and twists. So, as we know, effective altruists like to figure out where they're wrong and where they're willing, and find out where they're willing to change their minds based on good evidence and solid reasoning. So, what I'd like each of the panelists to share is where have you changed your mind about something, and how? And this could relate either to how you're funding, or this could actually relate to a decision that you took in your career where you were like, "Oh my gosh, for me it was I don't want to work in sales anymore. This is just not what I want to do. I want to." Shift my time and work in corporate social responsibility. So it could be a career move that you changed, you know, based on some evidence or solid reasoning, or it could be something that changed with regards to a project that you were working on.
Who are you asking?
I'm going to ask everybody, but anyone like to start?
Yeah, I'll start. So I can tell sort of my personal story of changing my mind. So my background's in philosophy, and last year I'm still finishing my PhD in philosophy on top of everything else. And I got into philosophy because I cared a lot about doing good in the world, and I thought that there was a bunch of interesting questions there that seemed unresolved, and you know, maybe smart people had the answers. But as I started, it looked like maybe the smart people didn't have the answers, and it also looked like writing papers about the answers probably wasn't going to be the most effective thing to do. Part of my background that's poker is I was supporting myself playing poker while in grad school. So I thought, well, I should go get a job instead of being a philosopher. That might be interesting. And I went to a foundation that seemed really good, the Lauren John Arnold Foundation. I was interviewed for an internship. I got turned down. I volunteered to work for free. And then a year later, I was running the department that I was interning for. And I decided to intern there because my mom said it would be a good idea. It turns out it was. So while I was there, the Arnold Foundation has a really broad mandate in terms of what they can spend money on. And I was doing a lot of thinking, like using my ethics skills and using the like tremendous amount of resources that the foundation had. I was doing a lot of thinking about, well, how can I do good in the world? And how can you use money productively? And when I started talking to people, I started talking to these people that said they were in the effective altruism community. And they seemed to have better answers to these questions than anybody else, and it really didn't even seem close. So I went to last year's summit, decided I wanted to work in the effective altruism community too, and then changed my mind from thinking that the like primary thing that was needed was money, although you know do some work with that with the EA Ventures. I think you really need to, like, I think solving the most important problems is going to be extraordinarily difficult, and the only way I can think of to do it is to build a community of people who want to do it with me. And so that's what I see as the thing that I'm most focused on now, and so there's sort of been lots of twists and turns in how I've been thinking about how to improve the world.
Cool. Thank you. Jason, how did you change your plans?
Well, so I can think of two. One is when I was a teenager, I thought the best way to lead a good life was just to make really good personal decisions about my own lifestyle. So trying not to contribute to cruelty, trying to treat people very well with respect. And I think all those things are absolutely true and important. But I think I probably underestimated the greater importance of making career decisions that could have orders of magnitude more impact than an individual's lifestyle choice. So I would say it was really only after college that it struck me, due to examples of people like Brian, who are able to accomplish so much through their careers, that making those decisions, developing those skills that allow you to pursue certain careers that then really can have orders of magnitude more impact on the world than your own personal choices. So that was one change of mind. I think another change of mind that had an impact for me was when I decided I wanted to try to find a career that was high impact, the first thing I thought, well, I don't really have any great skills except living cheaply. And so I thought, well, maybe I should try to get rich and just donate my money. And so I went to business school with that goal, and I was with other people in the business school who also wanted to get rich, maybe for different reasons. But I realized those people were really smart, they were really ambitious, they were really hardworking. What was the probability that I was going to become hyper wealthy? That is, that I would become sufficiently wealthy that I could actually donate more money than an organization that was already rich. I think I assessed that my probability of becoming a Brian or a Bill Gates was pretty low. I think I was right about that. So maybe as an investment banker or something, I could have earned a few million dollars a year. But, I mean, a foundation, if you're a program officer, you could move 10 times that a year towards really cost-effective work. Or if you're a program manager at IARPA or DARPA, you could move 10 or more times that. So it seemed more likely then that I would be able to affect the kinds of change that I wanted to, that work on the problems that most concerned me, by working for organizations that had budgets that were funding work that I thought was really important. So that was the other change I think that I took.
Thank you. Both really good ones.
So, some of you might have realized that I have this very strange name and a very English accent. And a lot of people think I talk like that, but I don't. And the reason why is because I moved to the UK when I was 9. I didn't speak English, and I moved over to the UK. My mum was a hairdresser, and we literally lived in a very small little apartment. We shared a bed, my sister, my mother, and I. We lived in this very small little place. And I, when I arrived in the UK, not speaking English and not playing cricket and not knowing what rugby was, and going to an English school at the age of 10 and trying to kind of immerse myself in being there, having come from Portugal, actually from a very small island off the coast of Morocco called Madeira, it made me realize very early on that I felt like an outsider. But it also made me realize and very conscious that there were an awful lot of other people like me. And actually, that was one of my motivators. It was one of the things that I had it from a very early age. And so actually, my dream when I decided to go to university and study politics, I wanted to be a politician, which is not something that people aspire to readily these days. It's become like a dirty word. But what it's also become is a profession. People don't today, if you want to be a politician, you want to be an elected politician, it takes you 25 years to get there. So people basically do it from the get-go. And I did. I got into the political world. I actually I worked in the US Congress. I worked in the UK Parliament. I worked in the European Parliament. And what did I learn was I really didn't want to be a politician anymore because I became incredibly cynical about the process. And then I decided to think about, well, how can I have an impact if I can't do it through what I thought were the right channels for me to go and do that, to have that impact on the world, and just to make the world a bit more equitable, because that was my ambition. And I hit on the idea that maybe I could do that through a company. So I actually joined Unilever, which is what I did, and I ended up running all their big work on sustainability. And you might think, well, so what? Well, actually, they had some really interesting goals. They had one goal, which was to give a billion people access to clean water, improved hygiene and nutrition. And they had a goal that 100% of all their raw materials would be sustainably sourced. And I found myself running smallholder farmer programs in Tanzania and Kenya. I found myself working on sanitation programs in northern India. And actually, for me, I found that I was having so much more impact doing that than I probably could have ever have had or ever have dreamt of having if I'd taken the kind of the political path on the slippery slope to power. And what actually I could do that without compromising my own values, because I wouldn't work for a company I didn't believe in. And I don't think you can. If you don't really believe in what the company you're doing does, you don't want to work there. I don't want to work there. So. But my moment in time, and I'll be very quick about it, was about 4 years ago. I went to a course. I got sent one of these kind of corporate courses that you normally hate. I normally hate going on. And it was about the notion of authentic leadership. And I thought, well, what was all that about? And I got there. And somebody, the first question I was asked is, what's your purpose? And I really had to think about it. And what I ended up realizing was that I thought my purpose was, I'm a communicator. I do communication. So what does that mean? It meant that I realized that my impact came from being good at communicating and using that skill to be a change agent and to incentivize people to do things, to become part of a network, a movement for change. And actually, that's my skill. And that led me, actually, they asked me there, well, what would you like to do in 4 years? And I wrote down, I'll either be at Unilever as the chief sustainability officer, or I'll go and join a foundation, or I'll go and work at the UN. And I ended up doing number two on the list because I moved to the Gates Foundation last November. So that's been my journey.
Yeah, you're such a psychic. It's pretty cool. I'm supposed to do this when Miguel talks too much.
Okay. And I wasn't looking. Did you not notice?
All right. So last but not least, Brian, is there going to be a monkey story here? Is that?
Yeah, okay. I have a monkey story.
I've heard about this monkey story now for a while, so why don't you go with it?
Yeah, so there's two things I guess I'd say on this question. One is the first big change in my life, I guess I had my mind changed, is when I was in my early 20s. I learned about biases and blind spots and hypocrisy, and I became totally convinced that I was a hypocrite, that I was biased, that I had blind spots, that I was overconfident in what I was doing. And it was one of the biggest revelations of my whole life that, one, these things existed, and that, two, even though I understood them, I still didn't believe them, and I behaved differently. And so as an entrepreneur, I do suffer from overconfidence a lot. And I have to keep myself in check because I know I have these biases, blind spots, and heuristics. And so when I was building Braintree, I wanted to keep all of us in check. And so I always told everyone a story that there's five monkeys in a room, and there's a basket of bananas on sitting on top, and the ladder goes up there. And so when a monkey goes up the ladder to get the banana, all the monkeys are sprayed with cold water. And it's obviously an unpleasant experience for the monkeys to do that. And so after a few times, the monkeys run up the ladder to get the bananas. They'll say, we're not going up the ladder anymore because we get sprayed with cold water. We never get the bananas. And so then you pull one monkey out and you put a new monkey in. This monkey's never been sprayed with cold water. And so what does the monkey do? He climbs the ladder to get a banana. And that monkey gets sprayed with cold water, as does everyone else. And so there's this community effect. And so what happens next is if the monkey tries to go up the ladder again, every other monkey will grab this monkey and pull it back and try to prevent them from being sprayed cold water. But the interesting thing is, one by one, you replace all the monkeys. And now you have five monkeys in the room, none of which have ever been sprayed by cold water. They just understand the behavior is, if a monkey tries to go up the ladder, pull the monkey back. But they don't know why. And so it's a key distinction of questioning your assumptions. Why do you do what you do? And we found this over and over again, that the assumption, your intellectual scaffolding is built upon all these assumptions. And if you dig down into the stack, there's huge things to be revealed. And so I learned, like with the OS Fund, just one more example, I had this idea of doing quote unquote good. But if we actually analyze good, we would have, whatever, as many people in this room, we'd have a different definition of what is good. And so I had to answer the question for myself is, what do I fund? How do I actually expend time, energy, and money to build what in the world? And what does my version of the world mean? And so I came to this conclusion that the best way to do good is to build good technology. But it took me a very long, and there's a whole bunch of stuff about that, but it took me a long time to go down the assumption stack to figure that out, which has, to me, been probably the biggest revelation of learning how to deploy resources for human flourishing.
Can I just say one thing about that? Because I think that's one of the conversations we were having before is, if you want to be an effective altruist, how do you understand what good is? And how do you make the decisions about where and how you can use and deploy? And I think that's a real barrier to people doing this. And it also, they get it wrong or they feel they've got it wrong, it breeds cynicism. And and it discourages people from doing more. So I think there's still a lot we need to unpack, because we make assumption that good is something that's self-evident, and in many instances, it isn't. And then how you measure and evaluate what good is one of the really big challenges that we're all faced with. That's certainly something we spend a huge amount of time doing in the foundation, and actually one of the realizations we have, I mean, what we do at the foundation essentially is we start by saying, let's evaluate the problem. And let's now narrow down on the thing that we think can make the biggest difference to fixing that problem. We then put our money, because we only have, despite the fact that Gates Foundation has a lot of money to give, it's actually very small when you compare it to the scale of the problem that you're trying to fix. So, you know, the foundation has 27 different areas we work on, and we have $3.5 billion we grant allocate each year. When you spread that across a lot of those programs, that's not a huge amount of investment. So you're actually looking to really leverage it smartly. When you make that decision, what you also have to be prepared to do is recognize you're taking risks all the time. You're making some big bets. You realize, actually, this thing, some of these things are just not going to work. And you need to know that from the get-go. It won't necessarily work. And that's not necessarily bad. But how do you get people to understand that when you take these things, not everything you do is going to work? And people's kind of sense that, well, if I've given, it has to work. How do you overcome that sense that there has to be a return on my goodwill? What's my payback? I think that's a real challenge for this movement and how people kind of understand that.
That's really interesting. Even given that with the rise of entrepreneurship and this whole tagline of, you know, fail until you succeed, you think it's still a very challenging environment?
I personally think that that's a real issue for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Myself included. I made a commitment to myself, not as ambitious as anyone else in this room, but at that time there wasn't a movement like this. These movements didn't exist. These are relatively new. And what we're talking about now transcends boundaries. It transcends national boundaries, cultural boundaries, lots of things we can do today that we couldn't have done 25, 30 years ago. When I was 19, I made a decision because I'd heard that the world, you know, 0.7% was the goal that every country had to give, you know, to reduce poverty. And I thought, well, if that's the goal, then I'll give 1%. Mm. And I said to myself, wherever I am, it doesn't matter what I do, I'll always give 1% of my wealth. Right. And I've done it ever since. But the reality is, you do feel like when I'm giving to something or to somebody or to some cause, how do I know that my money's not being wasted or that the organization I'm funding is doing the things I want it to do? And how do I understand what that is? And that's, I think, a real barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were talking before this... the panel today, and I thought the most interesting discussion we had was we use words like effective and good and things like that. Then we started digging down, like, what is the framework? What are you assuming is the case, right? Like, you exist, you spend time and money to do whatever. And we were trying to figure out, like, what could we do in this room that would create the most value for everyone involved? And I would hypothesize that the people in this room maintain a desire to contribute in ways that are meaningful to humanity, not just for the blind pursuit of wealth or whatever else, or status or whatever. My personal framing is that is Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot. If you look back at planet Earth, a very millions of miles away, and you wonder what will the humans and the systems and the technology in that Pale Blue Dot produce in the broader context of the universe? That's my frame in terms of how I understand what I do and why. And you know, Jason, you expressed your frame, but I think that if we all contemplated what our frame is and what we're doing and why, I think it would produce a very positive outcome for precision of effort instead of chasing something that may not exist and quote unquote good or effective, which really is just a mirage.
Interesting. That's really interesting. This movement is called effective altruism.
I know it is.
Should we think of a different word? No. Fair points, and I just want to commend you all for those stories. I mean, very personal, and you can see how deep some of this thinking runs in all of you and how you came to where you are right now in your lives. So thank you for sharing that. I think for the last section of this panel, I want to talk about the future of funding. And, you know, you guys are all thought leaders in your own respective spaces, but what are you really excited about investing in the future? And why. So I'm going to kick it over to Jason to kind of start that conversation and kind of toss that around.
Sure. I think we all, at least at IRPA, sort of have some of our pet rocks. We're term limited. We only stay there, you know, between 1 and 5 years so that our pet rocks won't gather too much moss, I guess, to mix metaphors. But the notion is you don't want to have a whole lot of institutional momentum that's driven by the technical interests of any one individual. So it's a way of keeping the ideas fresh. For me, things that I worry about include emerging technologies, cyber, bio, possibly easier ways to produce nuclear weapons, easier ways to produce chemical weapons, and accidents. I think more than anything else, I worry about accidents, because we have
accidents.
A lot more
what
of those.
Mean?
So we have a lot more accidents in biology than we do have instances of bioterrorism. We just need better systems for safeguards, better systems for detecting accidents when they happen, or for having forms of technical whistleblowing in communities where people see risk and they don't report it. So those are particular areas of interest for me, but I think the things that I find most compelling are the technical interests that I don't have that others bring to IARPA. And I mean, my job is to hire program managers who come on board for 1 to 5 years, are passionate about solving a technical problem, know that technical problem, and then find the best and the brightest in the world to work on that problem with them. And when those people come on board and they have a passion about a global security problem that they want to fix, whether it's treaty verification with nuclear weapons, or detecting disease outbreaks before traditional systems, that's what I get most excited about. And I would say that's an open invitation to any of you all who are scientists and engineers who have a problem that relates to global risk. Please email me and let me know. You could spend 1 to 5 years in DC working on that problem, as well as, you know, braving humidity in DC and terrible winters. But you could make enormous progress with a budget that you have to spend on high-risk, high-reward research. It's really unusual in the federal government.
Very cool.
Can I take a stab at
that?
Yeah,
I was going to say, Carrie, I mean,
yes.
Just given. Yes.
Sure. So the thing that I'm most excited about funding is stuff that I've never heard of before. So I want a project to show up that I'd never thought about, I'd never heard anybody else think about, but that actually seems amazing. And not only would that be good for me, because maybe I'll come up with a better plan than the current plan that I'm working on, but it might be awesome for the EA movement. Like, if somebody has an idea for a project or, like, a cause area that I'd never considered or people in the EA community don't talk about, it'd be great to tell people about that and, like, move more people towards it and resources towards it. So that's, like, one of the advantages of the really broad approach is, like, maybe that'll show up, and I really hope that it does.
Carrie, and that kind of brings us to that conversation we were having earlier about, you know, you said, we're definitely wrong about the four cause areas that we're currently talking about.
So what I was saying earlier is there's like this idea that EAs work on four areas. It's like global poverty, animal rights, X-risk, and META is what it's called. And this is like, I think, mostly because like one person had an observation that this seemed to be true after the first EA summit. And so thinking that that's what EA's work on, I think, is like kind of just crazy, right? Like, it's like we shouldn't be working on those areas because arbitrarily somebody had that observation like 2 years ago. So I think like we're almost certainly wrong that those are the four best areas, and I really hope we find new areas that are going to be even more productive and that are going to be even, you know, higher on the sort of impact scale.
Is that just your opinion, Carrie, or is that a lot of EA's opinion? Because I know there were books written with
sure.
those four
positive areas. Sure, so people who are working on like global poverty will think, yeah, that's true for everything except my thing. So most right. people will agree with that like as a statement. I think most people on reflection would think that like those probably aren't the best areas of all the possible areas we could work on.
Well, climate change didn't come up, did it?
Right, no, climate change. And yeah. maybe,
for example.
Yeah, yeah, so certain tail risks in climate change might be existential risk. So that would come up in that context.
Existential.
Cool. I think I'm going to end it with one last question because we only have a few more minutes. This was one we kind of chatted about earlier about the bottlenecks in world improvement. So if we look at the world, what's going wrong? Is it a lack of funding? Are we constrained by funding, meaning that like you know it's really that we need to put more money into the system to impact the world, or is it that we're talent and people constrained? Like, we need more people going out, starting really cool stuff. So just maybe let each of you kind of talk about that, but fairly quickly, because we're running out of time. But people versus money.
I can take a stab at that.
Okay.
My current guess is that we're mostly constrained by talent and not money. So I think this is true in the EA community in particular. I think there's lots of funding. I think you get funding to things that look promising faster than you get talent, because money's more fungible than talent. I think really talented people are usually capable of getting money. It's like part of the like sort of talent of being an entrepreneur. So I think more entrepreneurs, like more people who are starting interesting projects, is the thing that I'd like to see at the margin. But it's super plausible to me that that's wrong, because I don't have like a you know grand overview of everything. But that's my current guess.
Other thoughts? Counter? Or people agree?
For us, it's people. It's people. Program managers. People will come on board and drive programs.
So the largest constraint is that you don't have enough good people.
Yeah. We're always hiring. I mean, mm-hmm. because we have these term limits, mm-hmm. we're always hiring.
I have a different view. I actually think we have a lot of talented people, and we actually have an awful lot of money. Mm-hmm. It's just not being put together in the right ways. Mm. So I think the problem is it's about the ecosystems that we should be creating and we should be smarter about creating. Because I think there is a lot of money. As you said it yourself.
Well, you work at the Gates Foundation.
Yeah, it's not my money. I wish it was, but it's not my money. But the reality is that a lot of these, the things that we need to fix are systems that we need to fix. And that means you need a lot of different players to come together and work on these things. So I actually think the thing we're missing is collaboration and much smarter ways of getting these networks to find smart ways of getting together and finding common solutions to things. I get a bit fed up, I said it to you, I get a bit fed up with Pilotititis, which is lots of little things getting done everywhere but never scaled. And that's actually the challenge that I think we need to overcome.
Yeah, I would reframe the question, and I guess the thought that comes to mind is if you want to build a ship, you teach your team to yearn for the sea. And I think of like Leonardo da Vinci, where he had his famous sketchbooks where he imagined flying machines and scuba diving. And the difference between him and us, our time, is that he couldn't create what he imagined. He could contemplate this stuff, but he didn't have the tools. And I think the most shocking thing in our existence is that we just crossed this barrier in the past few decades that we literally have the tools to program any kind of world we can imagine. Your biology, I'm biology, the world runs on biology. We can now program biology. Computer software, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence, virtual reality. It is the most shocking development in the history of the human race. And I would say that instead of framing it in terms of people and funding, I would frame it and say that the most important thing is to reframe the identity and aspirations of humankind. What do we want to become? And that will orient what we build with these tools. But without that, we don't have direction in what we want to build.
Wow, that's brilliant.
It kind of goes back to the point about what is effective. You know, what do we want to build? It's almost like going back to the very basics and defining what is effective, what do we want to build. So Very cool. Thank you. Thank you all for joining this panel. It's been so great.